Nelson Ray White versus the state of Texas.
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, the appellant, Nelson White, was convicted of the offense of engaging in organized criminal activity in Jackson County. He is currently serving a 30-year prison sentence, despite the fact that the state's evidence was insufficient to support a conviction for engaging in organized criminal activity, and because, unfortunately, his trial lawyer failed him in several respects. I'd like to start with the allegations of ineffective assistance of counsel to group those together. So let me start first with the fact that Mr. White's trial attorney failed to raise a defense of the statute of limitations. Let me get into the facts just a little bit. The complainant in this case, Mr. George Weldon Burt, had a front loader and a John Deere tractor parked in a location in Jackson County. It was taken off of his property at sometime around maybe 11 in the morning on October the 2nd, 2018. We're very sure about the date because it was the tractor being loaded up was viewed by witnesses that testified at trial, and it was reported that same day as missing. So we know for sure what date our statute of limitations began to run. The indictment that Mr. White was tried on is dated May the 3rd of 2024. And if the court would, you have copies of the indictment as Appellant's Exhibit B. It shows a filing date of May 3rd of 2024. This is an engaging in organized criminal activity case with the highest level offense alleged is theft, a third degree theft. That would make this a 5-year statute of limitations.
He was indicted for the same offense in 2018, wasn't he?
No, Your Honor, actually. And if you also have a copy of that indictment, Appellants A, if the court will look, the indictments are significantly different. The indictment in count one, the first indictment on March 25th of 2020, alleges conspiracy to commit theft, engaging in organized criminal activity with conspiracy to commit theft. That is a completely different offense than what is alleged in count one of the second indictment. The second indictment alleges, first of all, that they engaged in organized criminal activity to commit the offense of theft, and also that they committed that theft as members of a criminal street gang. This second indictment substantially broadens the type of offense. It includes different manner and means. It is not appropriate to toll the statute of limitations with this indictment. The first indictment in Appellant A with the second indictment, because it expands the manner and means and adds an additional charge. Those indictments are sufficiently different that it does not provide notice to the defendant of what he's going to need to defend against in the second indictment.
And will you speak a little bit more as to, you cite to the Court of Criminal Appeals, the Tita case, and that the superseding indictment doesn't contain tolling language?
The second indictment does not contain tolling language. Tolling language would be language in the second indictment that says this case was previously indicted under this cause number at this time, and that indictment told the statute of limitations. There is no paragraph in the second indictment that contains tolling language. So on its face, the second indictment is outside of the statute of limitations. Also, I would point to the court to the West case, State versus West, where it talks specifically about the different offenses not acting to toll the statute of limitations. So because the allegations are different from Appellants A to Appellants B, Appellants A does not toll the statute of limitations. They should have had to proceed either on this indictment or this indictment. Appellants B should have been quashed. This should never have been tried. The statute of limitations is an absolute bar to prosecution. basically.
Wouldn't they just moved on with the first one? I mean, what's the remedy here?
If they had moved on with the first one, number one, I'm not sure that they would have been able to do an engaging in organized criminal activity conviction on this case. Count one does not include any allegations of continuing criminal activity by this combination, which is a required element for engaging in organized criminal activity. And this is the indictment that they decided to proceed on. B is the indictment they decided to proceed on. Mr. White's trial attorney should have made the motion to quash or a motion to dismiss this indictment based on the statute of limitations. Failing to do so has wound up with Mr. White serving this sentence. It greatly expanded the state's ability to prove this case by adding another count, and it did not give Mr. White sufficient notice. So his trial attorney's performance was deficient, and it harmed him because now he is serving a 30-year sentence on an indictment that was brought outside of statute of limitations.
If we were to sustain the ineffective assistance of counsel claim based on the failure of the trial attorney to file a motion to dismiss the indictment, what relief would be the appellant be entitled to?
The appellant would be entitled to a reversal and acquittal under this conviction because this is the indictment they proceeded under. Because a statute of limitations issue is an absolute bar to prosecution, if this was not brought appropriately, that conviction cannot stand.
But didn't the Court of Criminal Appeals in the Tita case in one of the footnotes talk about that actually the state could just refile with the tolling language?
In the Tita case, and I will check this, but if I remember correctly, in the Tita case, they had filed one. The defense attorney had filed a motion to dismiss that indictment, or I'm sorry, had failed to file a motion to dismiss that indictment. They could have, if that had been granted, they might have been able to go back and refile an indictment. That is not what happened in this case. They proceeded to trial. They made no objection at trial.
So what you're saying, if he was ineffective and he would have succeeded on the statute of limitation defense, then the motion or the indictment would have been quashed.
Yes.
But then they could have just refiled with tolling language. And then, so what's the prejudice? That's when we're looking at it from the ineffective assistance of counsel standard. What would have been different? I mean, they would have just gone back and filed an appropriate amendment.
If they had come back and filed an appropriate amendment, that still would not have, they still would not have been able to proceed under the They still would not have been able to proceed under this new indictment because it added language. It added a new method of committing the offense. It added a count of engaging in organized criminal activity and engaging in it as a member of a criminal street gang. That is, that would have been outside the statute of limitations. They cannot broaden their indictment. They cannot add new language. So again, in the West case, where the state did try to add tolling language to the indictment, the court upheld the motion to quash filed by the defense attorney because they filed new charges and new facts and allegations in the new indictment. So this new indictment with these new allegations still would not have been proper.
We're still talking about ineffective assistance. I think we want to hear about your motion to suppress.
Thank you, Your Honor. Also, Appellant C, the exhibit is a copy of the motion to suppress with the supporting affidavit that was presented at trial as the basis for obtaining cell site location data. The facts of this case are that the investigator filed or requested cell site location data based on a cell phone number and sought geolocation information and cell site location information for the dates of October 1st, 2018 to October 3rd, 2018. That's on page 3 of what was State's Exhibit 18 and is now Appellant C. You can see where they made their request. At the time of this search warrant, cell site location data was subject to the Carpenter decision that came out in June of 2018. Carpenter decision was the Supreme Court's decision saying that there is a privacy interest in cell site location data. The state of Texas had also recognized that, and 18B.354, the statute that authorizes and requires a search warrant for the cell phone information.
So there was a search warrant here. Are you complaining of the affidavit or just that the search was beyond the scope of what it should have been?
I'm complaining that the affidavit itself does not provide sufficient information to support a finding of probable cause. If the court reads the affidavit itself, it requests information, electronic consumer data relative to phone number 346-227-4737. Nowhere in the rest of the affidavit does it tie that phone number to either of the defendants or to the offense as it occurred on October 2nd, 2018. That means it is not sufficient under several cases, including the Baldwin case, and to support a search warrant. If there's not sufficient evidence or not sufficient ties to that phone number in the search warrant affidavit, it is insufficient to provide the magistrate with facts to find probable cause. They needed a search warrant to get that information and to present it at trial. Their search warrant is not sufficient. Because that search warrant is not sufficient, a motion to suppress on this issue would have been meritorious, and it certainly would have.
How would the outcome of the trial have been different?
The outcome of the trial depended on the cell site location data.
Didn't they get cell site location data from another phone as well?
We have the ability to suppress our cell site location data. So Mr. White had the ability to seek the suppression of his own cell site location data. Whether somebody else's cell site location data was presented at trial does not prevent him from seeking the suppression of his own, because they have to prove his involvement as well as somebody else's involvement. So he has the standing to seek suppression on that because it applies to him and him alone.
But wasn't there evidence that they were together on that day?
Well, the only evidence that showed that they were together on that day would have been either the cell site location or the accomplice witness testimony of Blake Powell. Mr. Powell was the only person that put them together, the only person that could corroborate that those two were together other than the cell site location data. So if the cell site location data is gone for either one or both, then Mr. Powell's testimony is unsupported by any other evidence and as an accomplice witness and indicted accomplice witness. That was not sufficient to support the conviction.
How do you respond to the state saying that the privacy right wasn't implicated in this instance because of the short period of time or the one day, the specific times that they were looking at the cell data?
I disagree with that for several reasons, and if the court will allow me to finish that answer, I'm almost out of time. First of all, there is a privacy right, a privacy expectation in cell site data location. We know that because the Supreme Court has said that in Carpenter, and the Court of Criminal Appeals has reaffirmed that. There have been recent cases that have dealt with Google location data. The Wells decision was a plurality opinion. And in Judge Newell's opinion, where he specifically talks about Carpenter, he's the one that talks about, well, there was maybe a temporal or a spatial limitation there. That's not what we have here. So again, if you look at the warrant itself and the request on the warrant, that would be page 4 and 5, the court can see exactly what all they were looking for. And we're not talking about a 3-hour period of time. 3-hour period of time was what was presented at trial. They asked for 3 days. And again, this is also implicating a little bit of what the Fifth Circuit and the Court of Criminal Appeals is going to need to address with geofence warrants, because this number is not tied to anybody connected with the case within this search warrant.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge.
May it please the court. Because only two issues were discussed here, I would like to stand on my briefs on issues 2 and 4. And I would like to briefly touch on issue 5. But the two issues that I believe are before the court that have been argued are the ineffective assistance claims. And I'd like to start off, if I may, by just sort of reiterating the standard of review when it comes to an ineffective assistance claim. In an ineffective assistance claim, you're looking at whether or not the attorney himself, the attorney, made a mistake so significant that he violated settled law. In order for him to be found ineffective in this case, you would have to find, and the standard for when counsel fails to raise an objection or motion is whether the motion would have been granted and whether it would have been granted based on settled law. The Court of Criminal Appeals has said, for counsel's conduct to be deficient, the specific legal proposition the client faults counsel for failing to assert must be well considered and clearly defined. In other words, this is not a case where counsel properly raised a motion or an objection. The trial court denied it, and you're here reviewing whether or not the trial court's decision was correct. If that were the case, then you could review even unsettled law and make a decision one way or another. But when you're talking about ineffective assistance, you're talking about whether counsel made a mistake so significant that he violated the client's rights to have him apply settled law and to protect his rights under settled law. Our position is that under neither of these two issues, neither point, has the appellant proved that settled law entitled him to either challenge the indictment and win on the indictment based on limitations, or that he would have been entitled to win on the motion to suppress.
When you look at this affidavit that was the basis for getting the location of this particular cell phone, there isn't mention of where the officer, the affiant, got the information about this particular phone number. And it talks about the facts as he conducted his investigation, but doesn't say anything about how anyone is tied to this particular phone number. Why shouldn't we say it's an attorney should have seen this and filed a motion?
Right. Your Honor, although I hate to concede error, I couldn't find that affidavit was sufficient either. But the underlying question is, did the defendant have a privacy right in that data? And if he didn't have a privacy right in the information, the warrant is superfluous. You can get data without a warrant, without any justification, basically, if the client has no privacy right in it. And that's where the cases of Carpenter and the Supreme Court case of Carpenter and the Court of Criminal Appeals cases of Sims and Holder are key, because they establish this window. Carpenter and Holder both involved 7 days and 23 days. And they were very clear that if you have an extended period of time like that, a privacy right attaches. Sims, on the other hand, said that a 3-hour period does not implicate a privacy right. What we have here is a warrant that said 3 days, but disregard the warrant. The actual data used at trial was a single day. Does a single day implicate a privacy interest? As I said, if this case were here before you, on a motion to suppress that had been denied, it would be a very different question, because you might have the ability to say, we think 24 hours implicates a privacy right. But this is couched in terms of ineffective assistance. In other words, you have to say that settled law shows that he has a privacy right such that his attorney should have raised a motion to suppress. And let me put it in these terms, if I may, an ineffective assistance claim. Sixth Amendment guarantees a defendant, a criminal defendant, the right to effective assistance of counsel. It guarantees him the right to counsel who will study and know settled law and assert his client's rights under it. You might say it entitles him to afford F-150 lawyer. Now, every client is going to want a Rolls-Royce lawyer, one who's going to push the envelope, one who's going to make motions that might extend the law in his client's favor. But the Sixth Amendment only guarantees you the Ford F-150 lawyer. And in this case, he got the Ford F-150 lawyer. And I believe, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, it's okay. I was just going to ask you on that point, on the ineffective assistance of counsel. Appellant relies on a case out of the 12th Court of Appeals, Compton. And is there a way that the current facts you can distinguish it from the finding by that court that there was ineffective assistance when they failed to raise the defense on the statute of limitations?
Yeah. I think in this case, it's precisely because it's evident from the record that there was a prior indictment, that all they had to do, the counsel is not required to do what would be effectively a useless act. And to raise the fact that the tolling language was not in there would in effect be a useless act. When there was an indictment ready and in the waiting, the state could have simply added the tolling language.
But appellant also claims, though, that these are completely different offenses.
And I disagree with that, Your Honor. Again, if we look back to the ineffective assistance, the lens that we're looking at this from, it has to be settled law that he would be entitled to relief. Now, the most recent, you know, might say the most recent seminal case on tolling is a case called Hernandez. That used very broad language when it talked about tolling. It said a prior indictment tolls the statute of limitations for a subsequent indictment when both indictments allege the same conduct, same act, or same transaction. That was very broad. There have been subsequent Court of Criminal Appeals cases which have pulled it back a little on with regard to specific offenses. And what they've looked at is the gravamen of the offense and have said basically if the gravamen of the charged offense, the presently charged offense, is different than the gravamen of the prior offense, then it may not, in fact, toll for those purposes. There's yet to be a case which has examined tolling under Hernandez for an engaging case. We don't have that. We have to basically decide whether or not and how tolling would apply to it, which again amounts to unsettled law.
And I'll ask you the same question I think that Justice Fonseca asked is, then what's the remedy here? Because he didn't ask for, or he didn't complain, so there was no new indictment with the tolling language. So now we have him tried on an indictment that didn't have the tolling language. So what's the remedy?
Well, the remedy, I think, would be to send him back for a new trial. Now, at that new trial, you know, presumably if we assume that he couldn't be tried on the new indictment, his counsel would have to raise that at that time. But what we have here is simply ineffective assistance, which entitles him to a new trial.
And is the state conceding then, as is required by the TEDA case, that there should have been tolling language?
There should have been, but again, counsel is not required to do a useless act. And if counsel had challenged the indictment and it simply would have required the state to include the tolling language, that would essentially have been a useless act.
Well, I mean, that was my question. Can they still do that? If we were to say, yeah, there was a mistake here and we send it back, remand it to the trial court, then would they have to re-indict him with the tolling language? And could they do that?
I think they certainly could, yes. They certainly could re-indict him and just make explicit, yes, we've got tolling language here. But because it's in the posture of ineffective assistance, and because we know that limitations can be waived, you'd have to find that counsel...
That's what we would say here, that counsel should have done it, and he would have succeeded. So then now we're sending it back.
Yes, Your Honor, the state would disagree that counsel is required to do what would effectively be a useless act, though. I mean, that's our position, that if counsel, you know, and it's clear here, And it's only clear because we have, in fact, the prior indictment as part of the record. It's clear here there was a prior indictment. For certain reasons, I'd like to argue, I think it was absolutely clear that prior indictment did toll the statute of limitations. So to hold counsel to have to file a motion to quash and then simply turn right around and have the state say, okay, we'll put the tolling language in, would essentially be a useless act. It wouldn't be necessary. Counsel would simply be delaying things. And counsel may, you know, if we're imagining the reasons counsel does things, counsel may have wanted to go to trial more quickly than that. He may have seen this and said, you know, I could file this motion. It would only result in a delay of trial. I don't want to delay trial. I want to go forward. That would be a plausible reason for counsel not to file the motion to quash. And because we don't have a hearing where that's fleshed out, we don't know. There are several reasons for which I disagree with counsel if this was a different indictment. This was, for one thing, they point out four things in their brief that would distinguish the prior indictment from the present one. And the first one was that members of the combination, they say, were different. Well, the key members of the combination, Nelson White, Jesse White, and Blake Powell, were the same in both indictments. The second indictment added a few other members. But the key component of engaging in organized criminal activity, which only requires three, it only requires three participants, was the same in both indictments. And in fact, the Court of Criminal Appeals has said, in the case we cited, State versus Duke, that while the names of the members of the combination may be required as an evidentiary matter, their omission from the indictment does not render such defective. So it wasn't even necessary for them to name all of them. They simply named a few extra members of the commission, of the combination, which the statute tells us could change over time as well. So we believe that's a non-issue as far as tolling. Second, they say the first indictment alleged conspire to commit, whereas the second indictment alleged the actual commission of theft. If you look very carefully at the language in the first indictment, it did allege conspire to commit, but then it turned around and alleged as the overt act all the elements of actual commission of the theft. It effectively alleged commission of the theft as well. And we know from a recent case, Crawford versus State, that you don't necessarily have to take the indictment on its face when it says it's alleging this particular offense or that offense. What you look at is the factual matters alleged in there to see what offenses are being raised.
And wouldn't they, under the second indictment, wouldn't they have had to show that there was an ongoing criminal enterprise? I mean, it's more than just conspiring to commit theft.
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, the ongoing criminal enterprise is the gravamen of an engaging. And in both cases, they alleged a combination, which is defined as an ongoing criminal enterprise. So you have the same thing in both cases. If you read the indictment, the language of the indictment, in terms of the definitions of engaging, both of them are alleging the same thing.
And is the state just relying on the evidence of a combination, and you're conceding that the state failed to prove that the appellant was a member of a street gang?
Yes, and that's another thing that they say is a difference here. That the first indictment alleged combination, the second indictment added criminal street gang. Even if you were to agree with that, and yes, they did, you know, if you were to agree that that's a major distinction, the proof at trial, I think, if you look at it, will clearly show we were relying on the combination theory. And in fact, the only evidence of membership in a criminal street gang did not involve these defendants. It involved a couple other people. There was no indication these defendants participated as members of a criminal street gang in the offense in question, only that they participated as members of a combination. So if you want to take out that language and say criminal street gang shouldn't have been added, that's fine. The evidence at trial showed it was a combination. The final thing they say is that there was an inclusion in the most recent indictment of the allegation of two or more offenses pursuant to the same transaction. If you look at that in the first paragraph, there's a clear reason that was there. And that was to show that both the theft and the engaging were part of the same scheme and could be alleged in the same indictment. It was not to add to the elements of or exemplify the elements of engaging. It was simply there to show, hey, we're properly charging these two in the same indictment. So for those reasons, we believe that counsel should not be held ineffective. And under the prejudice prong as well, as I think Your Honor mentioned, with regard to the motions to suppress, there were two people traveling there. There's an indication that their phones were together all the time. So if you throw out Nelson, you've still got Jesse. If you throw out Jesse, you've still got Nelson, neither of whom are entitled to rely on the other one's privacy interest. And we don't think you have to get there, but if you happen to have to, if you believe you have to get there, we do think there's a lack of prejudice. If I may touch briefly on what I think is the other major issue, and that's the fifth one, which has to do with abandonment. The claim is that during the charge conference, counsel abandoned the elderly enhancement. The Court of Criminal Appeals has said that the state may, with the consent of the trial court, dismiss, waive, or abandon a portion of the indictment. And they've used the terms unequivocally abandoned. They use that term several times in their opinion in Duran. And I think it's important that they use that term. They're not just talking about a casual abandonment. They're talking about an unequivocal abandonment. Here, the state, during the charge conference, made it clear he wanted to abandon the theft count. But as sort of a shorthand of that, he said, well, it's everything on page two. Page two count included the theft count and the age enhancement, which applied to both counts. So there was at least some equivocation, some uncertainty as to whether he was abandoning that age enhancement or whether, as he said, he was only intending to abandon the theft count. And if you read...
It was added in the final charge and there was no objection to it, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And that was what I was going to say. It was added in the final charge, no objection. It appeared that everyone understood that he was not abandoning that. And in fact, even if you take a real technical view of it, and say, well, you know, his language here, we can read that as the prosecutor's intent to abandon that. The state, the other portion of that is the trial court has to consent. The trial court made very vague comments, but in the end, it included in its charge the age enhancement. So that at least implies that the trial court, even if the prosecutor technically voiced his intent to abandon, the trial court didn't consent to it. It included that in its final charge. Unless there are questions, I'll stand on my briefs for the other arguments.
Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Norman.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You may begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to address Mr. Norman's contention that these matters are not matters of settled law. First, I'll start with the allegations regarding the statute of limitations. Mr. Norman raised the Hernandez case. I am assuming that he is speaking about Hernandez v. State, 127 Southwest 3rd, 768, which is a case from 2004, 20 years before this new indictment was filed. The Court of Criminal Appeals said a subsequent indictment is barred by the statute of limitations if it broadens or substantially amends the charges in the original indictment. The West case, which reaffirmed the holding in Hernandez, was in 2021, 3 years before the new indictment was filed in this case. The West case is also instructive because it talks about something similar to this case, where the state changes the allegations in the indictment, adds new manner and means, and puts new information out there that the defendant then would have to go back and investigate. That is also well-settled law. The Compton decision that holds that a court can, on direct appeal, find a trial lawyer ineffective for failing to raise the statute of limitations defense, I believe, is in 2012. These are not brand new opinions that a trial lawyer can be forgiven for not knowing on the spur of the moment. Those would have been issues that would have been researched prior to trial and should have been raised prior to trial. As far as the information about cell phones, I briefed this a little bit in my previous argument. Carpenter was decided in 2018, prior to the events of this case even happening. The Supreme Court had said unequivocally, there is a privacy interest in a person's movements such that the Fourth Amendment requires a warrant supported by probable cause to get cell phone location data. There is a privacy interest here. And if the state is conceding that
always, there's always a privacy interest.
Carpenter does not state that there is not always a privacy interest. I realize that there have been some opinions raised about the possibility of temporal or spatial limitations on geofence warrants. The Fifth Circuit has not held that that's the case. Their opinion in Smith seems pretty unequivocal that geofence warrants allow for rummaging through somebody's daily movements and that there's not a time frame where that'd be okay without a warrant. And the Sims case is not really about cell site location data. It's about ping that they got from a company for 3 days worth. It's talking about three pings to a cell phone in the possession of the defendant. This is factually distinguishable. And in any case, again, the search warrant itself asked for 3 days worth of materials and asked for everything from that cell phone. These are not questions that haven't come up. These are not issues that an attorney would not have researched. You're required to have a command of the facts and the law applicable to your case when you take a case to trial. And that was not done in this case. A motion to suppress in this case, as the state concedes, would have been successful. If he had brought the motion to suppress, he would have been successful. The cell site location data for his client, and the state still has to prove his client's involvement, would not have been corroborated by, would not have been proven through cell site location data. There would have been no corroboration of Blake Matthew Powell, the fact that another cell phone was there, and the other cell phone might have belonged to Jesse White, whose search warrant affidavit was also deficient. He would not have been able to support the conviction just on Powell's testimony alone.
But your client can't rely on somebody else's privacy interest.
No, but he can rely on his privacy interest. And if he relies on his privacy interest and his cell site location data is taken out of the equation, then what the state has left, assuming that they have Jesse's cell site location data, is the fact that Jesse's cell phone may have been there and an accomplice witness is testifying that they were involved. Nelson is not implicated in that if his cell site data is not there. They can't prove that he was there and participating in that theft, and they've got to prove that theft to be able to prove engaging in organized criminal activity. They have to prove at least one criminal incident. They can't prove that he was participating in that if his cell site location data is not there.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
This case will be under submission.